Welcome to Rethink, a podcast focused on the future of skilled nursing. I'm Amy Stulick, reporter with Skilled Nursing News. I'm joined for this episode by Clifton J. Porter II. Cliff very recently was tapped by American Healthcare Association and National Center for Assisted Living to be its next president and CEO starting this fall after serving as the association's senior vice president of government relations. Cliff has been in the business for 35 years, starting out as a nursing home administrator in Virginia before taking on a more advocacy-focused role. He expressed excitement to put unique solutions in front of policymakers as part of his new position, while also reflecting on how lobbying for the sector has changed since the pandemic. Before we get into that conversation, I'd like to highlight the Rethink Conference taking place on September 11th and 12th in Chicago. Rethink is a premier skilled nursing event that brings executives together to address trends, challenges, and the future of the nursing home industry. We have a great lineup of confirmed speakers, including executives with companies such as Genesis Healthcare, DiversiCare, American Senior Communities, Avamere, and more, addressing topics such as the staffing mandate, of course, and managed care pressures, QAPI and survey challenges, best practices and strategies for growth. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to find out more. And now, my conversation with Clifton J. Porter II. All right. Well, thank you so much, Cliff, for joining us today. Just getting right into it, you know, I would love to hear about, you know, your reaction to, you know, getting the promotion to president and CEO of AHCA and NCAL. I was just excited to hear that news for you.
No, well, thank you for setting this up. And, you know, I want to start with kind of saying that everything has been pretty overwhelming. Many folks may not know, but I've been at the in the business now for 35 years. And to end up with my peers validating me leading them is an incredibly humbling experience for me. So I'm really grateful. I probably am a bit introspective during the time, particularly when the decision was announced. And I think, you know, the other piece is just the outpouring of encouragement and support from folks that I've known all that time and some not as long, but just an overwhelming amount of support, you know, from not only our constituents, but folks on the Hill, policymakers, just lots of really good good feelings and mojo coming from the community. So, just really excited about it. And again, a bit overwhelming, but excited.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you are the first African-American, right, to hold the role as well. A lot of firsts.
Yeah, no, that I don't think should be overlooked. You know, in this sector, it's interesting, but you know, when I started 35 years ago, I may have been the second or third practicing administrator in Virginia at the time that was African-American. It was kind of like that in school as well, a little bit where I went to school, particularly in the field of study I was in. So I'm a little bit accustomed to, particularly in our field, sort of being encountering this phenomena of sort of being the first. I don't focus on it a lot, to be honest with you. It's just not something that I focus on. But you know, I'm definitely grateful. You know, I think about you know, the opportunities for folks going forward, and I hope you know, me being here inspires people to, you know, look higher and reach higher, and hopefully I'm not the last. So you know, again, we'll keep chugging away, and hopefully there'll be more that look like me in the future.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Being the first, but not the last, something to keep in mind, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then looking ahead, I'm curious what direction you plan to take the association in. You know, how will you meet it? I feel like we're in such a pivotal point for nursing home history, you know, considering the pandemic, the ever-present staffing challenges, and also the possibility of a minimum staffing mandate.
Yeah, well, the future, you know, for me, at least from my viewpoint, is bright. And I think, you know, in many ways, we have to continue to build on the foundation that Mark built here at ACCA, as well as our members, in really focusing our efforts on quality and being a mission-driven organization. And I think it's just really important that we remain mission-driven. And, you know, we want to continue to focus on improving lives by providing solutions for quality care. And that's our mission. And I think it's all encompassing, and I don't ever see that really changing. You know, again, we've got an amazing, I want to call it a launch pad, frankly, that we built, Mark has built over the last 10 years. And I think it's just important that we not only learn from the past, but look to the future. So when we think about the past, you know, one thing I learned very early in my government affairs experience is that if you're divided, you fall. You accomplish nothing divided. It's just the nature of democracy and politics and policy is about consensus. And it's about, you know, getting majorities, if you will, groups moving issues and getting a broad consensus. And if you're divided, you can't achieve that, and nothing ultimately happens. So, you know, again, Mark started his tenure at ACCA with a pretty major coup, if you will, almost, of bringing two large organizations together. And since then, the organization has continued to grow. So, you know, obviously we need to continue that and look for opportunities to expand our membership. And then I think one thing we absolutely learned from the pandemic is the importance of coalitions. You know, it's nothing like a disaster to bring people together, right? And, you know, during that time and during that disaster, you know, all of these different organizations were really forced to work together. Maybe it was PPE. I can think of hundreds of examples where our operators were sourcing PPE and giving it to the hospitals and the local health centers in their communities and doctor's offices. And then, you know, that would get reciprocated. If somebody else found PPE, they would share it with the greater community. And it really didn't matter who you were or what field you were in. Everybody really worked together. And I think what that's done is created a bit of a habit, if you will, going forward, where there's been, you know, mutual respect and I think appreciation from the pandemic, and has allowed us to really look at our world and say, okay, what things do we have in common and how can we continue to work together? So, you know, when you look at things like the staffing mandate, when you look at, you know, the pandemic and the effects of that are continuing to be more and more in our rear view. But when you look at all of those different kinds of issues, they impact us all. And I think, you know, what we've learned is that we can be very, very effective together. So one of the major initiatives we're going to be focused on is going to be to continue to expand and identify alignment and expand these coalitions and work together. And I think workforce is a perfect example of that, but there are many others. So we got to continue that work. But I think it's a lot of opportunity ahead of us to be able to be even more effective by working together.
Exactly. And then, you know, you've been serving ACCA and Cal as Senior Vice President of Government Relations for quite some time. How do you think that your skill set in, you know, what you're doing right now will help navigate the current headwinds faced by the industry?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's something that, you know, I have to think about a little bit. But I think, you know, to start, you know, and again, I talked about my career path, you know, and again, it was in operations as a nursing home administrator, really. And, you know, our operators and administrators out there every day really learn how to solve problems, and they're used to, you know, sort of facing acute issues that may come up. Somebody fell last night. We have a survey that we weren't expecting. You know, there's always this element of being prepared for the surprise and being always ready. That's just a part of, I think, operators' DNA. And at the core, that's kind of what who I am. I mean, in my office today, I do it on purpose. I have my Virginia and my Maryland administrator's license looking me in the face every day. I'm inactive in both states, obviously now, but I still have those credentials looking at me just to remind me, you know, that this is who I serve, and to never stop thinking like an operator, because ultimately that's really what advocacy is all about. So, you know, from that vantage point, I think that approach, that training, that reality really prepare me well for the government affairs role. But what's happened there is you learn strategy more than anything, how to get things done. So that role has really been instrumental in developing strategic skills and kind of thinking through decisions, policies, actions. If we do this, and this will happen. If we don't, this will happen. If we go in this direction, this will clearly happen. This will not. Who will be impacted? How can we get consensus? I mean, there's just a variety of things that you have to think through. And I think the government affairs role absolutely prepared me, you know, for this next step. So, you know, a CEO, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot for me to learn. And I'm already beginning that process as we speak. But I think, again, at the core, our members want us to advocate ultimately in Washington. That's why our association exists. So coming from this background, obviously, is going to have me pretty well prepared for that component of the job. And then I think, you know, we have to continue to do what Mark has always encouraged us to do. And that's, you know, offer solutions. I mean, we all know that there are problems. There are always going to be problems. And I think ultimately, even the folks that we serve, even our critics, you know, we can agree that we have problems. I think oftentimes what we disagree about is the solution to those problems. And it'll be, you know, my goal at least to ensure that we continue to be innovative, thoughtful, realistic, and bold with solutions. And those solutions folks may not like always, but ultimately what we're doing now and on many fronts, just, you know, as a society, just isn't working. So we got to do things differently. And it's my intention to really put those different unique solutions in front of policymakers and hopefully achieve something great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like what you said about it seems kind of like a balance between realistic solutions and bold solutions, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, moving ahead and working with a bunch of different folks. So you touched on this a little bit already, but I'm curious what upcoming ACA and NCAL initiatives you're most excited to see in action going forward.
Yeah, no, I'm super excited. I mean, we've got a lot of very exciting opportunities in front of us, but more importantly, sort of ideas and innovations that we've been cooking up internally. And, you know, the one thing that, you know, I just think we have to always just keep dead center in front of us at all times. It again gets back to my operator administrator days. I mean, I could, you know, the thing that hit me about doing that for the period of time that I did was I really felt ownership to take care of people. I felt responsibility to do it. It was, you know, I woke up every day saying, okay, it's my responsibility that these people are protected. It's my responsibility that, you know, their care goals are achieved. I mean, I just took it really seriously. And I think, you know, that is analogous to what we do at ACA, particularly in the area of quality. I mean, we have to continue to advance innovative quality initiatives. Our quality award program is something we're super excited about. We've got record applications to get on the quality journey. It is not a paper compliance, you know, fake. I use the word fake, but I don't mean it necessarily pejoratively, but it is a challenging process and a very structured progression with our Baldrige accredited program. And, you know, we have more and more people getting the silver awards and ultimately the gold, and lots getting in the bronze area, which is sort of where you start You can't just become gold. You kind of have to work your way through. And the program is exceptional. It's rigorous. And I think it's just something that keeps all of our members focused on quality. And then I think also, you know, it's all about measures and ensuring that, you know, we're helping our members stay focused on, you know, what matters, you know, what really absolutely matters. And I think a big part of that is just making sure that we can provide as an association important data and continue to improve our data capabilities to give our members actionable information that they can use to improve quality. So, and we're doing that. We've got Trend Tracker is a good example of that. Our members, if you're a member of the association, you get to enjoy a very robust data set that helps you understand where you are with quality on important metrics and how you compare to others. So quality is everything in my view. And we've got to start with that and keep that front and center. And then, you know, workforce is obviously the elephant in the room. And it's a biggie. And, you know, again, I'm sure we'll have time to talk about the mandate, but I think it brings to focus an issue that's been an issue for a long, long time. And that is that, you know, we have a structural deficit of caregivers in this country. And that's not unique to long-term care. That is something that is pervasive throughout the healthcare community. And when you look at particularly registered nurse education going forward, there's a potential 200,000 to 450,000 shortage of RNs by 2025. So we're talking next year, we're at almost a half million nurse deficit, and we've not even hit the crest. We're nowhere near the crest of the baby boomers actually awashing the entire healthcare system. So this is, in my opinion, probably the most critical issue that I think policymakers in particular are largely ignoring right now, that we have to fundamentally do something differently and do it soon, because if we don't, I think we're going to have real problems throughout our healthcare system. So, you know, I think that there's got to be real policies, and we're going to be working hard at that. And back to your point about coalitions, looking at ways to get other groups where we can work together to really come up with a plan and say, okay, we've got to make investments, and here are the targeted investments. This is where they need to be focused, you know, and in doing so, hopefully start to turn the tide, if you will, on those numbers. So international nurses is a biggie. You know, immigration is something we always talk about. It's probably the greatest conundrum that we have in our country politically. Tuition reimbursement, loan forgiveness, you know, housing, child care. I was just with an operator in Detroit yesterday. Spent a day, and I'm intend to do that quarterly. I've done it some, but I want to get out and go to different parts of the country. And I'm actually going into facilities. So I went to, I think, four facilities in the Detroit metropolitan area yesterday. And this one owner, he bought a property to build this new facility in inner city Detroit. And it's the first nursing home built there in 50 years. And wow. They build a building, it's brand new, it's gorgeous. And with it, with the property, they got this kind of condo building as part of the buy. He didn't tear it down. Some of his longstanding CNAs a home, gave it to them. So, you know, you talk about innovation, right? I mean, that brought me to tears. But, you know, you've got, you know, folks now that actually have housing. And I think it's those kinds of ideas and opportunities that are out there that operators are embracing and being innovative. And we've got to continue to do that if we intend to turn the tide on workforce. We got to think of new ways to not only attract people, but get them to understand what it is that we do. I'll close this part of the comment. Yesterday when I was in Detroit too, there was a cadet program. When I was walking through this building, and again, it's in inner city Detroit, so it's a very urban setting, largely African-American community. But when I'm there, I see these young kids look like they're high schoolers, and they all have these shirts and they're cadets. And it's a program with the public schools where essentially they work at the facility. They work in the kitchen. They work in, helping with nursing and doing all these things, just getting exposed as teenagers to what we do. And I just think that's beautiful. And I think it's the kind of work that we have to continue to do. Think creatively. And how do we get to people's hearts? And I think a young person, if they can get bit early with what we do, they'll fall in love with it. And in spite of how challenging it is, be in a position to make a difference. So I had some real up close opportunities yesterday to see some of these initiatives in action. And it's really exciting.
That's amazing. Yeah, definitely have to follow up with you on that too. For that Detroit operator, I've heard of other operators offering housing subsidies, but, just saying, here's a condo, we really need you to, be working for us, helping us out. And, this is our way to give back is, amazing.
Absolutely. And members of none, we got one member in the Houston market in Texas, every year. He gives away a car to a brand new car, not any car, a brand new car and a good car to a direct caregiver every year in his company. Every year, a direct caregiver gets a car and tenure, the quality of their work, their consistency as it relates to attendance, all that. But again, transportation is a critical component. For folks that are caregivers, childcare, critical component. There's just so many different challenges that our direct care workers face that, we have to be careful not to be oblivious to. It's very different than some of the challenges that, that I may face today. And I think, again, we see operators really, embracing that, understanding that and doing something about it. And it really makes me smile. So anyway, I'm sorry for going on about it, but it was such a feel good kind of moment, and it's the kind of stuff that folks need to see.
Absolutely, yeah, and just being innovative about it and thinking about issues facing staff members, CNAs, RNs, whoever else, kitchen staff, it's something that needs to be said, I think. So I want to go back briefly, to a question related to your role in government relations. I'm curious if you think that lobbying for the nursing home space has changed, given its spotlight in national media and, coming out of the pandemic as well.
Yeah, I think it has. Again, I've been doing advocacy work 20 of the 35 years in this business. So I've definitely seen some shift and change. And I think there are a couple of themes associated with this change and shift. I think, obviously the first one is, we've seen just a growing demand, if you will, for services. And we've seen a lot of innovation as it pertains to our delivery model. So we've shifted and changed from, just a basic kind of custodial type center and convalescent center. I mean, I remember there were a lot of years where you would go around the country and you would see, the names of the facilities was, Richmond Convalescent Center or something. I mean, and that was kind of the nature of the work. And based on, these changes, the perception around what we do has changed. And I think that's been a positive. We're delivering care in different ways. When I was in Detroit yesterday, one of the facilities was in the process of finishing a dialysis unit in their facility. There was another facility that had a ventilator unit in the facility. There even thoughts and ideas about how do you merge partnerships with hospitals and in some markets, ambulatory surgery centers. How do you you know, more or less combine and coordinate and collaborate with those kinds of operations. So there's just been a significant amount of innovation in the field. And I think as a result, it's changed the narrative a little bit in DC, at least as it relates to how we advocate. Unfortunately, though, what we've seen is sort of a gripping to the past by certain policymakers, at least, where they basically fundamentally feel that, you know, we've got to continue to do things the way we always have. And that's lockdown on, you know, nursing homes. And we don't need to change what we do. We just need to intensify the penalties and you know, kind of push harder, if you will, on the sector. And that's ultimately the solution. And, you know, I argue that that's a, you know, that's a 1970s solution to a 2025 problem. And we all want to improve quality, but, you know, we've been doing it the same way. I mean, regulatorily, at least, you know, as long as I've been around, and it's gotten worse. And it doesn't work, and nobody's happy with it. So if we're not happy with it, if the public's not happy, if regulators aren't happy, we should do something differently. So I think, you know, again, you know, when it comes to how we advocate, we definitely have to push against sort of an archaic viewpoint about what we do and how we do it. The second piece, which you alluded to in the question, which I think is even more meaningful, and that is that I do think the pandemic fundamentally changed how we're perceived.
Mm-hmm.
It fundamentally changed how we're perceived. Oftentimes, we were ignored or not seen. And I say that, you know, as a consumer, you know, I had to put my mother in a facility before she passed and had to care for her. And I've done this my whole life, and, you know, and I couldn't get around the emotion. And I was falling in the same traps, you know, that I've seen people do as customers. I mean, I was finding myself like, why am I saying this? You know what? I know better. You know, I know what's going on, you know, but again, there's this emotional construct to things. And again, you know, our society wants us to do something for their loved one that they no longer can do. And in their minds, they're guilty about that. I should be able to do this, but I can't. This person did this for me, and I'm incapable of doing it for them. And so I trust this facility to do it. But guess what? When I give her to you, you'll never be able to do it as good as I could or as I can. And therefore, I become ultra critical of everything you do because of my own guilt. And that's the dynamic. And I think what COVID did was, one, you know, it obviously created a situation where, you know, we had residents unfortunately isolated, separated from their families for inordinate amounts of time. You know, I think a lot of the, you know, the damage, I think there was probably more damage from loneliness as it related to the pandemic than the pandemic itself. That's my theory. There's probably some study out there to say that. But I had my wife's mother, lady who helped raise her. She died of COVID. We said goodbye on an iPad. You know, it was hard. It was horrible. You know, it was hard. It was horrible. But, you know, again, all of those experiences have brought what we do to the forefront of policymakers' minds, and particularly during the pandemic, we were everything. I mean, during the pandemic, we were everything. We were, you know, health policy. And I had members of Congress, you know, saying, Cliff, I need a Zoom. And I mean, I'm talking an hour one-on-one with multiple members of Congress trying to understand what's going on and figure out what's being done and what needs to be done. So going forward, folks kind of, I think, appreciate us a little more. They definitely listen. And I think in many ways are open to our ideas in a little bit of a different way because of the impact that we had. Now, folks want to blame us, you know, and there's still some of that goes on, you know, around the consequences of the pandemic. some of the justifications for the staffing mandate, you know, it irritates me when I see that. But, you know, the administration has used the pandemic as some justification, you know, like, give me a break. But that's what they did, and critics do that. But that's I think, becoming a less and less credible position. And we're hearing a little less of that, and I think a little bit more support. So I'm finding it to be, post-pandemic, a little bit friendlier, if you will, or folks are a little bit more open to what we're doing, and at a minimum, at least understand the important work that our operators do every day.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You know, at the very least, more communication and more curiosity, right, to understand, what operators are doing every day.
Absolutely.
At the very least. And I'm glad you mentioned the staffing mandate. I did have a couple questions on, the mandate, but also the lawsuit as well that you folks are spearheading. I'm curious if you have any updates on the lawsuit to stop the federal minimum staffing mandate.
Yeah, so nothing significant, if you will. Obviously, I think everyone's aware that we filed. And the federal government has yet to respond. We're waiting their response. But, you know, again, there's no major updates. We anticipate a ruling, hopefully, late, this year, December-ish to early part of 2025. Beyond that, it's just sort of in process, if you will. Leading Age joined the lawsuit, which has been a great development. And I think I definitely use it from an advocacy perspective. You know, there's often this, critique that it's the for-profit owners that don't want to do this. And, there's some profit motive to cut staff or not provide enough staff. And for that reason, we're against the mandate. And, that argument evaporates when you have nonprofit members, faith-based members, opposing right. it for the same reason. So it just makes that argument, moot. So, having them as a partner is incredibly important. I'm grateful to the team at Leading Age and Katie Sloan for helping us with that. But that's where we are. So, hopefully we'll have some news here end of the year, some good news.
Mm-hmm. And I know that, one of the biggest twists that I saw since the lawsuit was filed is the Supreme Court's Chevron decision. I'm really curious if this decision will affect the outcome of the lawsuit for you folks.
Yeah, I'm not an attorney. I'm laughing now. I'm gonna see my son here in a little bit. He just finished law school. He's studying for his bar. I think he takes his exam in a week. So he's all stressed out about it. But anyway, I've kind of talked to him a little bit about this. Just to kind of get his thoughts. As a recent law graduate, and obviously it's a scenario around administrative law, which I'm no expert. But, when it comes to the ultimate decision, I think the fundamental components of the case, and our objections remain. And I'm sure that the judge will entertain all of those points. I think we're hopeful that it impacts the outcome positively, but it's no way for me necessarily to tell. I'm a little cautious when it comes to stuff like this, though. It's a lot of talk about Chevron. And it's just, at this point, we really don't know, in any context, exactly what the repercussions, ramifications will be. I think it's fair to intimate that it's positive, but, courts are funny. Interpretations are funny. And you just don't know. But we're optimistic and grateful for the decision. And not only are we hopeful that in the future, at least as the law unfolds, and particularly as the case law unfolds around this post Chevron, that not only does it help us on the staffing mandate, but potentially helps us on other issues as well. So we'll see. Again, we're hopeful.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I had another question here, you know, related to the Chevron decision, if it might more generally affect the federal agency's authority on regulations impacting the sector. I think you kind of alluded to this a little bit, but any other commentary you would want to make?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think, there is no question that our regulatory construct needs to be, and I don't say reformed. I don't like to say repealed. I like to say rationalized. We have an irrational system, and we need to make it rational. And again, we all recognize and accept and frankly embrace, our members embrace regulation. We have a very important mission that is responsible for caring for vulnerable people. And that kind of industry or sector or profession has to be regulated. So we embrace the concept of regulation. It's just right now, it's just gotten totally wacky, irrational. It's inconsistent. It's, geographically different. It's the only area, I would say, the only, sector where an A is not an A. I'm in school. I'm studying a little bit now. And, you know what your grading scale is. You know what the syllabus is. You know what the book is. You know the rules. And then you work to the rules and you get a fair grade. In our case, that's just not the case. It's just in many cases, regulations are vague. They're broad. They're open for interpretation. One state, fines you $100,000. Another state doesn't cite you at all for it. And it's just bizarre. So we've got to change that. And I think, again, when it comes to overreach, which essentially, essentially what Chevron's saying is that, there's the courts and the statute itself speak for itself, and the courts should base their decisions on the statute, not defer and support what the agency does. But the law effectively is sufficient to, and judges are sufficient to make those kinds of determinations as it relates to compliance with the statute, not a regulatory agency. And I think to some degree, what that does is it just ultimately says, look, there has to be process, due process, disciplined process in sort of making decisions about these kinds of issues. And that's ultimately in a very simple, at least that's the simplest understanding I have of it. And, we've got so many regulations that fall in that category of being vague and being interpreted differently that I'm optimistic and hopeful, that there are a variety of areas that particularly once, this is in full swing, provide some opportunity for our operators to actually challenge, and hopefully we can get these things fixed. And again, it's not to eliminate a regulation, but it's no reason that, when I go into a facility, I run a facility, I ought to know what an A is, what a B is, what a F is, and I ought to be able to work towards it. And it shouldn't change. The goalpost shouldn't move. It shouldn't matter who the teacher is. That's the inspector, analogous to the inspector. It really shouldn't matter who that is. I know what I'm dealing with, and I can work towards improving quality. And that, that will have, I think, a variety of impacts. We talk often about, the strain and stress that this construct provides on our staff. We talk about workforce all the time. I mean, one of the biggest challenges in workforce and the government's critical of, in some cases of our ability to recruit and retain staff. Well, guess what? The regulatory construct is not something that makes our industry appealing. There are a lot of other places that are easier to work and a lot more fulfilling. And you don't feel like you're getting beat up every day about, something that may be, in the real world, relatively insignificant. So, I think, again, Chevron, rationalizing regulations, the lawsuit, all these things, hopefully, and that's going to be my focus, at least over the next, or at least my time here, is really rationalizing these things, because I think if we do all of it, we get to where we want, and that is we want to improve quality, we want to lower turnover, we want to improve staffing. And I think if we can do all that, make this a more favorable environment to work in, we'll be able to accomplish that, and Americans will get better care. And that's really what it's all about.
Absolutely. And one more question about the mandate. You know, I'm curious how members have been preparing for, you know, these assessments that are coming up next month. And then just, you know, how should members really prepare for the mandate overall, especially with its implementation in question, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as the assessment component, that's something I spoke about during a congressional briefing because I felt like it was, you know, coming up and folks weren't talking about it. But we've gotten some tools out to our members. And again, that is the earliest compliance date. That's, I think it's August 10th is when that goes into effect. So, you know, we've got tools and our members are already, you know, getting these assessments in place. So we're operating under the, you know, realization that this is, you know, this isn't going anywhere. It is, and we got to respond and prepare for it. So, and it's August 8th, by the way, and not the 10th. But with that said, we're getting ready, and I think our members will be well prepared. And I think, again, we just got to continue to do, and you know, again, part of this assessment process is what are you doing to get staff? And, you know, our members are doing, as I shared earlier, amazing creative things to get staff. So, you know, we got to keep doing that. And, you know, ultimately, you know, I think, you know, we'll be successful in defeating the staffing minimum because it's just wrong, not just in principle, but I think in statute it's wrong. And I think we'll ultimately win. So we're getting ready for the assessments. And I think, you know, we'll be prepared and compliant when the time comes.
Absolutely. And I have a couple staffing questions for you as well. You can shift gears here a little bit. So, no, at the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned immigration, right, as it relates to staffing solutions. And I'm curious if there are any updates on ACA's position on facilitating an immigrant labor pool, right? And has ACA been pushing for the fast tracking of nurse visas?
Yeah. So it's a kind of thing when we talk about immigration, I bang my head on the wall because it's just so common sense. It's just so common sense. And unfortunately, in our country, this issue has become so politically divisive that we can't get anything done. I mean, I'm talking about even the most basic kinds of things. So when you talk about, as an example, the Healthcare Workforce Resiliency Act, which we support, you know, this is a very basic bill. And essentially all it's simply saying is this: during COVID, you had a certain number of visas that we gave and we allowed. And because of COVID, we couldn't do it. We couldn't bring anybody into the country. So let's use those visas instead of we lost them effectively. Let's use them. They're there. They were, you know, we just couldn't due to extraneous factors. Let's use it and let's pull it forward to bring some new folks in this country to provide, you know, a variety of care in different settings as well. You know, no matter, it's not just long-term care specific, it's healthcare specific. So, I mean, that's just common sense, right? Okay, you had a rule, you know, you got X coming in every year. We couldn't bring them in those couple of years. Can we use those numbers now to help catch up? And we can't get that. That's a problem. And we've got bipartisan support on that. So you had a bill where you had bipartisan agreement and then it died, you know, you know, so it's just, it's very, very frustrating. But we're obviously going to stay resolute. And I think we're ultimately going to get to a place where we're going to be able to get something done. But again, I think that immigrants in particular are a vital part of our workforce. I mean, if you go to certain parts of the country, they are the workforce, and not even part of, they are the workforce. So again, you know, we've just got a lot of work to do. I wish I could say, and I wish I could be more optimistic about, you know, immigration policy in our country, but as it stands right now, I'm not. I just think that it's such a politically volatile kind of topic that it just becomes an immovable issue for us. So, you know, again, I think with that, we got to be creative, right? We got to think about, you know, other ideas, not just on immigration, but how do we create more workers? How do we create more domestic training programs? How do we facilitate more RNs being moved into the workforce? How do we incentivize more registered nurses to work in rural areas? I mean, we learned during this mandate debate, and this is one of the reasons Senator Tester, you know, became our champion. I mean, again, he's the most politically, at least, vulnerable Democrat in the Senate. And, you know, he flat out opposes this reg. You know, I mean, flat out opposes it and has been highly vocal about it. And the reason is simple. He's like, there ain't no nurse. This is his words, not mine. Cliff, there ain't no nurses in Montana. There are no RNs. We don't have enough as it is. And you put a mandate, it's going to get worse and more facilities are going to close. And he lost 15% of his nursing homes. And he's like, we can't continue to do this. This doesn't make sense. So we got to figure out ways to incentivize folks to work in rural markets and rural areas. How do we do that? What are some creative policies to help us drive more of a presence in rural areas? How do we educate more people in rural areas? How do we do the same in urban areas? How do we, you know, so again, I think it's a multitude of we have to do everything. It's not like something, any and everything that we can do, we should be doing. Progress on any one of those components is success. And unfortunately, while immigration would be a huge win, I just remain pessimistic, at least in the near term, that we're going to make any progress on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like what you said about it being kind of like a multi-pronged solution, right? Like there's no silver bullet, but I think it's true for the staffing issues that you folks face. So before I let you go, I just have a couple forward-looking questions that we like to ask all of our Rethink panelists. You know, just curious what you would rethink about the skilled nursing industry.
Wow. Yeah, that's so much to rethink. I think I really feel that, you know, when we look at how we view, it starts with how we view ourselves, you know, and I am, it's my hope, you know, in my time in this role that I can inspire our operators and everyone that works in this sector to lift up their head, to square their shoulders, and to speak loud and proud about what we do. To not be ashamed, to not be hesitant. You know, I'm a, what do you do for a living? I'm a healthcare administrator. No, I'm a nursing home administrator. No, I'm not a healthcare administrator. No, it's more specific than that. You know, no, what kind of nursing do you do? I work at the nursing home on such and such street. I'm not I'm an RN. No, I'm an RN at X facility. You know, we need to stop being bashful and I think to some degree ashamed for whatever reason. And I know what the reasons are. It's just that, you know, we're so criticized, it just becomes hard to own what we do. But I'm proud of what we do. We should all be proud of what we do. So I think we need to rethink who we are and more importantly, how we portray ourselves to the world and be more proud and loud about who we are and what we do. And I also think that, you know, and that applies to, you know, assisted living, you know, the entire long-term care continuum. You know, but I think, you know, again, we have to really begin to also be more vocal, in my view, and sort of rethink how we feel our role is within our individual communities. And that's particularly the political way. I mean, I would love to see every member of Congress, every senator in every state have a person or persons in their state that essentially are their long-term care cabinet. You know, they're the local people that tell them, you know, what's going on in the business, that they trust, that they value. And those relationships take time and it's work. But it's going to be something we're going to really be pushing to really have like real ambassadors on the ground that these members of Congress value and these staffers value, and they call and they lean on when they need to get information or when someone comes to them with some idea or thought about a change. So I think we need to rethink our role in our communities. You know, we are ambassadors. We're ambassadors for the field. We're ambassadors for our sector, and we're ambassadors for the patients we care for. You know, and at the end of the day, you know, I remind people, our operators are licensed professionals that are held accountable by law to provide care and service. Hospital administrators don't have to get a license. Nursing home administrators have to get a license. We have to be licensed professionally. And with that comes legal responsibility. So this is not, you know, a, you know, passe kind of industry. It's serious business. And I think, you know, again, we need to sort of understand that, own that, be proud of that, and talk about it. So, you know, that's at least how we need to view ourselves. And hopefully policymakers, and I think COVID did this to some degree, you know, I hope policymakers just begin to see us as part of the solution within the healthcare continuum. And obviously the capacity needs going forward in the future are going to become more and more important based on just the demography within our country. And hopefully, you know, they start thinking about us as not only a solution, but how can we better leverage these facilities in different ways to create sustainability for the future? Because the financial models for facilities in our country, you know, is varies from state to state and community to community. And, you know, if you look at a state like Montana, you know, you got residents that have to drive 110 miles to see their family members. That's ridiculous. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. I mean, that just is bizarre that we even have policies that allow that. But we do. So I think policymakers need to rethink that, similar to what they did with hospitals, as an example, critical access hospitals. Those are hospitals that are low volume hospitals, but they have to have them in communities to make sure care is available to people. So, again, that's just one thought, but there are a variety of different ideas. I think that, I'm hopeful at least policymakers embrace and start to think about us differently and view the work that we do in a way that's constructive. So anyway, that's just some thoughts.
Of good thoughts to end our conversation here, Cliff. And just wanted to say how much of a delight it was, and you know, really great to hear your insights on a variety of different topics. Thanks so much.
Well, I appreciate you, and thanks to your listeners. And you know, again, we're open. So you know, folks know how to get hold of me if you got ideas or thoughts about anything I've talked about or any other great ideas. Please share them. We need all of the input that we can get to move things forward. So I view this as a bit of a family affair. So let's all continue to lock arms and march together. And I encourage your listeners to reach out. If there's anything we talked about that you have some thoughts about that makes sense, please reach out. I'd love to hear from you.
Well, that does it for this episode of Rethink. I'd like to remind listeners about our upcoming Rethink Conference, taking place on September 11th and 12th in Chicago. Visit skillednursingnews.com/events to learn more and get tickets. Until next time, thanks for listening.